From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. 1 hour from now, President George W. Bush will tell the nation that major combat operations by U.S. military forces in Iraq have come to an end. He'll make that declaration from the USS Abraham Lincoln, now sailing toward the California coast from the Persian Gulf. It will not quite be a declaration of victory, but it will be the first last word on this war. Tonight on Point, War and Consequences, toting up the impact of the war in Iraq. We begin in Washington, where USA Today Pentagon correspondent John Diamond has been following war and post-war plans in Iraq. Good evening and welcome, John Diamond.
Hi, Tom.
John, give us a sense of the backdrop to this presidential speech tonight. We're told from the flight deck of the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln. At this point, what's the number of U.S. military still in Iraq, and what's their deployment now?
Well, there are approximately about 100,000 forces in Iraq, combined British and American. They're already starting to cycle home, but the deployment is essentially now to spread through the country and to try to reach the corners that haven't been reached yet, especially north of Baghdad, and establish some sort of order within which Iraqi political groups can form a new government.
We've seen the trouble that troops have been having in recent days, especially in Fallujah, just outside of Baghdad there. Is the notion that U.S. soldiers will be in every city, town, and village in Iraq, will they be essentially the cops on the corner for a time?
For a time, they certainly will. The coalition forces right now are collecting arms and confiscating them, shipping them out of Baghdad by the truckload, one of the commanders said today. And so they're trying to disarm the country before there is the establishment of any kind of armed force to maintain order of Iraqi origin. The trouble is that the U.S. troops are under orders to protect themselves, to defend themselves if threatened or fired upon, and that is a formula for the kind of firefights and exchanges we've seen that could lead to casualties and build resentment.
So it's not going to be an easy deployment. What about the time frame? How long are these kids from Akron and San Diego going to be sitting in Iraqi villages?
It's unclear. The Bush administration is saying that they will be out as soon as possible. Now, there's a political element to those statements, political within Iraq itself, because saying they will be gone as soon as possible, it appears to be code for saying that power will be turned over to the free Iraqi militia under Ahmed Shalabi of the Iraqi National Congress. So there's a concern within Iraq. There's a split within Iraq as to when they would like to see the Americans leave.
John, let me interrupt you there. That's very oblique code to an outsider. Is the Pentagon still presuming that their man, their exile, Ahmed Shalabi, who had not lived in Iraq for, 40, 45 years,
right,
is going to be the next leader of Iraq? Is that the determined position of the Pentagon still?
Certainly not the publicly stated position, but in background briefings, senior Pentagon officials make it very clear that they support Shalabi, they defend him, they debunk the criticisms of him that come from within Iraq and around the Arab world. So he has staunch defenders in the Pentagon. They don't want to come out and publicly say he's our man because that goes against the whole notion of Iraq creating its own government. But there's a sense in the Pentagon that in the absence of a substantial U.S. force staying over a sustained period, it would automatically fall to the Iraqi National Congress forces to establish order.
Mm. Let me just further clarify the deployment here then. At this point, we still have a lot of troops there. What about war fighting equipment? Is it being pulled out? Are the Abrams tanks driving back down to Kuwait and treading back up onto the freighters to head home? Or are they going to be staying long-term in Iraq as well?
Well, there is I would call it a gradual pullout, but there's still a tremendous amount of military hardware in the country, if nothing else, to present a visible show of force at particular points, especially in some of the key points around Baghdad, where the new government is to be established. Some of these meetings have taken place in buildings guarded by a whole phalanx of M1 Abrams tanks. So it's not a total pullout. The The most visible pullout right now, of course, is from Saudi Arabia as the Americans pull their aircraft out of the huge Prince Sultan Air Base and move everything over to Qatar.
And is there a sense in the Pentagon today, John, certainly Donald Rumsfeld seems to convey it, but that this changes everything for the U.S. military in the Middle East, that the board will be reshuffled now, both in terms of troops and perhaps in terms of vistas of possibility?
It does. There is a sort of twofold desire. One, to get a sort of bounce from this military victory, to sort of send a signal to other countries that this administration regards as either adversaries or potential adversaries, particularly Syria and Iran. There also is a reshuffling of forces to countries that are more likely to be supportive of the U.S. in its military action. Saudi Arabia was, of course, a reluctant partner in this particular campaign. And what we're seeing is a movement of military forces out of Saudi Arabia to Qatar. We're also seeing the same thing in Europe, where Secretary Rumsfeld has made clear forces will be moved out of bases in Germany and moved into bases in Central Europe, the new NATO members, such as Hungary, Poland, etc., countries much more vocally supportive of the United States because of their gratitude for having been allowed into NATO.
And, John, you're the Pentagon correspondent. Is there anything in particular you'll be listening for in the president's speech tonight, or is this all high seas backslapping and theater?
Well, it's certainly symbolic in theater. I mean, at the Pentagon today, that you can believe that the Navy people were high fiving each other for the PR boon they're getting by having the president.
It's hard to picture many other presidents in the jumpsuit on the deck, you know, coming out of the fighter plane. It was quite a picture.
If you're an advocate of carrier air power, it doesn't get much better than that. The symbolism, I think, will be to both say that the main fighting is over, but that some difficulties could remain. I think that the president, you're going to see a focus on what's been accomplished, not what has not been accomplished. So there won't be much mention of those weapons of mass destruction that have yet to be found and that we heard so much about before the war and that were indeed the basis for this war. So there's going to be a focus on establishing a new democracy, on getting rid of a tyrant, on the success of U.S. forces in this campaign. I think he may use some language that perhaps was provided to him by Rumsfeld's office that may talk about a transformed military and a new way of fighting, about preemptive war and the need to use force to protect Americans as well as project power and contain adversaries. So it's certainly symbolism. There's an AP story on the wire tonight calling it the first stop on the president's reelection campaign. Clearly, it's being seen through a political lens. You know, the declaration that the war is over is certainly not news. It's been known for a couple of weeks now.
But it sure is a great picture.
Unbelievable picture. And you'll see it all over tomorrow's papers.
John Diamond, you've been very generous with your briefings throughout the war. We're very grateful for it, and thanks for your insights.
Oh, you're welcome. I enjoy it.
John Diamond is Pentagon correspondent for USA Today. He joined me from Washington. George W. Bush made the first presidential tailhook landing in history today on the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln. In less than an hour now, he's scheduled to address the nation from the high seas and declare an end to major combat operations in Iraq. Historians will interpret and reinterpret this war for years. Tonight, we take a crack with author Paul Berman, who sees the war in Iraq as one battle in a fight against totalitarianism. We want your view as well. How do you sum up the meaning, the significance of the war in Iraq? What did it accomplish? What did it represent? Did you support the war going in? Do you support it now? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Paul Berman, political and cultural critic and author of the provocative new book, Terror and Liberalism. Good evening and welcome, Paul Berman.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Hello, Jack.
Hi.
Paul Berman, what are your thoughts tonight? You must have seen the TV pictures today, unless you're studying away on the next great book, but you could hardly miss it on the tube. There's the president standing on the deck. He hasn't even given his speech yet, and already it's a real high-five picture. What are your thoughts as the president stands there on the aircraft carrier, tonight, fully embracing a military that's just done a big job about this war and what it means.
My thoughts are full of anxiety and worry. I think so far so good, but the real test is what remains ahead. I do interpret the war in Iraq as a war against totalitarianism. From my point of view, we've been engaged in this war for decades, really, in different versions. And if you look at the past, I think you can see that what really matters is what happens after a military struggle. I can give you an example. In Germany, to defeat the Nazis in Germany was, from a military point of view, a tremendous feat. But if, after the Nazi military defeat, the Germans remain Nazis, if the Nazi Party remained powerful, if Nazi ideas had continued to dominate German society, what would our military victory have done for us? It would have helped a little, but we would have still have been in serious trouble.
Which just gives a sense of the potential challenge post-war. But I want to roll the tape back just 1 minute here with you, Paul Berman. When you say so far so good, you know that there was, before the war and during the war, a large school of thought that this was a tragic mistake. It was not the dominant, it didn't carry the day, but that this war would, in fact, set back Americans' larger interest in the so-called war on terror rather than propel those interests forward or make progress in that larger war. Were you never of that view? Are you not of that view now? Do you think that this is actually a step forward, not a step back?
I always considered that the war in Iraq was part of the war against terror, and for this reason. The terrorist danger to us, the terrorist threat, has never come from just a tiny handful of people who could be arrested by the police. It's always come from a very large movement that's been supported with some enthusiasm by many millions of people who enrolled in a variety of institutions and political parties are sometimes supported by states, have banks and all kinds of institutions supporting them. From my point of view, the Ba'ath tyranny in Iraq has been part of this larger culture of totalitarianism in the Middle East. To overthrow the Taliban in Afghanistan was very important, was a step. But it was only a step in what has to be, from my point of view, a larger rollback of the totalitarian movement across the region, in the Arab world and beyond.
Jack Beattie, I want to bring you in, and pardon me, Paul Berman, we'll be right back to you, but I just want to get Jack in here. We're searching for the meaning, the significance here tonight, Jack, and it's still very early on. It'll be a long time before people really know, can really understand. But Paul Berman is ready from the get-go to separate the totalitarianism from the Muslim culture, to say we can go after this totalitarian thing, I guess, without offending that culture in a way that makes it a worse enemy. What are you thinking tonight, Jack?
Well, I'm thinking that suppose the president had given a speech last year based upon what the truth that seems to be emerging, and it said to us, my fellow Americans, I think we need to topple Saddam Hussein. The reason isn't because he has weapons of mass destruction. He may have them, but you know, the general who told us credibly that he didn't have nuclear weapons also told us that he had destroyed his weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. The CIA says if we attack him, if he does have them, that's the dangerous point. He could give them away. And it isn't because he supports terrorism. Our State Department in its report last year said, no, we can't find any connection with Al-Qaeda. And it's not because he has the potential to expand. We've got him contained there, and his army is small. Lives will be lost in this war, and the occupation that's going to follow, things could go terribly wrong. We could wind up shooting at demonstrators, creating a Shiite guerrilla war against us, and the bill will take billions from your tax money and domestic programs, and it'll take years, but we should do it, because this is a totalitarian dictator, and he's an affront to humanity.
But that's not the story we heard.
I don't think that gets 10 votes in the U.S. Senate.
Well, We're gonna keep digging in tonight on the meaning, the significance of the war that's just gone by. The president will be speaking in less than an hour. You can join the conversation. What did, what does the war in Iraq mean to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255 with Paul Berman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. As the president prepares to announce the end of major combat operations, we are talking about the meaning, the significance of the war in Iraq tonight. Our guest joining us tonight from Brooklyn is Paul Berman, author of the new book, Terror and Liberalism. You can join this conversation as well. We really want to hear from you tonight. What, in your mind, does this war represent? What did it accomplish? Is this a victory of liberal democracy over totalitarianism, to use Paul Berman's framework? Do we know yet? How will historians judge this war? Was it moral? Was it immoral? Was it brilliant? Was it a blunder? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to invite our callers in early tonight. Alexis is calling from Pittsburgh. Hi, Alexis. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good evening.
Basically, what my comment is that by President Bush going against the UN Security Council, I think he has set us back even farther. I mean, and I see no possibility of peace negotiations with the people of the Middle East. I mean, why would they want to work with us? I mean, I don't, we're going against UN, I mean, we're going against the one organization that has been established to promote peace, and here we are completely going against it. I mean, I don't.
Doesn't feel right to you?
No, it doesn't. And I think it, I mean, for years we've been trying to keep peace in the Middle East by going through the UN Security Council. And now it, I mean, we've blatantly just come out and said, yeah, you know, we just don't think you guys have what it takes anymore. And we're just going to go about this ourselves. And I don't.
Alexis, we've got it. And that clearly is one big potential victim here. Thanks for your call. Paul Berman, how do you see this element of the United Nations having been so sidelined, the U.S. victory well and truly without it? What does it portend? What does it portend for peace in the Middle East? What does it suggest in terms of your worldview of this struggle between liberal democracy and totalitarianism?
Well, I think that there's no doubt in the world that President Bush is, from the point of view of being a diplomat, one of the worst presidents there's ever been. I think that we had a what should have been a popular position all over the world, and he managed to turn it into an unpopular position. And I think he weakened the United States militarily and politically by doing this. And a great deal of the blame for this certainly belongs on his shoulders. But I think that even so, sometimes it is the case that is necessary to go beyond the UN, even against the UN, in order to defend oneself and to defend other people's lives. If we hadn't gone in, an example is the Kosovo War. In the Kosovo War, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people were being persecuted in the most hideous and grotesque way by Milosevic. Nobody was defending them. The UN refused, absolutely refused to defend them. And Clinton and Blair and the other NATO leaders decided to go in anyway, rescue those people, even though the war was, from a United Nations point of view, illegal. And I think that was the right thing to do, to allow those people to be massacred and driven out of their homes just because the UN said no. That would have been the wrong thing to do.
But, you know, whatever the reality may be, many people see, and we've heard this repeatedly voiced over the last months, the United Nations itself as a kind of, if not bastion, then at least a beacon of eventual kind of global democracy, as a kind of symbol of international, at least consensus building, which now appears sidelined. Is there a danger of the symbolism being wrong here? If you're talking about the U.S. Leading a fight for liberal democracy, that the sidelining of the UN may look like a kind of rebuke of that representative organization.
Right. And in this way, as I say, I fault Bush's diplomacy. The way Clinton handled this was he went into Kosovo anyway. He ignored the UN. But after having gone in, he brought in the United Nations after the fact. And so Clinton was able to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And at the same time to affirm the principles of the United Nations. And that's really what I wish Bush would do now, that he should do everything he can after the fact, since it was impossible before the fact, to affirm those principles. But even so...
That would sound like a stretch at this point, wouldn't it, from this president?
It would be a stretch. I don't expect it from him.
Jack, what's your view? This is clearly a big outcome from this war, a vastly... changed, I guess, diminished profile for the UN. They're certainly one large piece of significance somehow.
Yes, I think so. Is it the case that it's been injured, or that we've just awoken to the reality of the UN? I mean, I'm not sure it wasn't working anyway. Yeah, and that really it was the sum of the individual wills of the states. And when the states' national interests conflicted with the UN, the states just used the UN for its own purposes. I mean, I think we saw that with France, which voted for this resolution, and it said 1441, and it said there'll be serious consequences. Everyone knew what that meant. And then because of domestic political situation, finding that it was favorable to come out against the United States, the French seemed to reverse course, and to, just for reasons of the making the president of France popular, take another position. Of course, about the same time, the United States, while professing that we wanted the inspectors to go in there and that we were going to abide, we were making every effort in the world to get our troops in there and making clear to anyone with eyes to see that we had no use for the inspectors. This was a charade. We were going to go to war no matter what. So there you have two great nations basically saying to the UN, look, if we can use you, fine. If not, we don't need you.
So wake up and smell the coffee, world. This is how it is. Bill's calling from Stone Lake, Wisconsin. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing tonight?
Fine, thanks.
You know, I think this has been a real unusual conflict in that, while, you know, many people think the war started, you know, a couple months ago, really, when you look at it, this war started in 1990 when we had the first invasion of Iraq and kicked them out of Kuwait. Mm. It never ended after that. I mean, we flew flights over it. We bombed their stuff from now and then when we needed to, when our planes were threatened. This war started way back when. Frankly, I think Bush was wise to go in and finally put an end to it.
So you're glad he stepped up and took the big step.
Running thousands of sorties every year, mm-hmm. forever. Mm-hmm. You know, if we went along with the way the UN wanted to do it, there was no resolving the situation with Saddam Hussein.
So there's kudos from you, Bill, for a president who said, "Well, let's just go do the big job."
You know, sometimes if you want the job done right, you just got to do it yourself. And the United Nations, as was mentioned previously, you know, they had dropped the ball on Kosovo, and they were totally willing to drop the ball on Iraq, and it's pitiful.
Bill, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Paul Berman, this goes directly to your thesis. You write about, I mean, a vast long war. You tie it all the way back to the fascisms in Europe, and you see that thread coming through the Muslim world here to be fought. But in the 90s, from the first Gulf War right through the whole sequence of terrorist attacks in Saudi Arabia, ultimately in New York, in Africa, you've got Bill's same observation here to some degree, that this was one long war that we just stepped up to in a bigger way.
Right. I worry about people who lose the forest for the trees. That, to my mind, it's the forest that's important here. And the forest is a large totalitarian movement that's been devoted to mass slaughter, a politics of massacre, that's been devoted to the worst terrorist atrocities. And these terrorist atrocities have finally come and hit us. And I think we've finally woken up to that, in some degree at least, and we realize that we have to defend ourselves, and the way to defend ourselves is to defeat these movements, and to defeat them with the only way in which a totalitarian movement can be defeated, which is to overthrow it and replace it with at least the first steps towards creating a liberal society.
But is it possible that there's just so much history of colonialism and intervention for oil here that we can't pull apart the totalitarian layer you're talking about and the rest of Muslim society, culture, anger, memory? We've heard stated so eloquently here that we will inevitably estrange and embitter a billion-plus people and turn them into even worse enemies. Is it possible that sometimes you can't just go in guns blazing, even when you don't like the social order that another culture is producing?
Well, we didn't go in merely because we didn't like the social order. We went in to defend ourselves, first of all. Also, we didn't like the social order. But I don't agree that the culture produced the social order. I think that a particular political party, particular political movement managed to seize power in Iraq and do these terrible things to the Iraqi people above all. From my point of view, there's something a little wrong with our whole discussion, which is that we've been wringing our hands, and I agree with this, over the United Nations. We've been worrying about infuriating a billion people. We've been thinking about all the terrible things that are, that have happened. But we haven't really reflected on the fact that 20 million people were freed of the Taliban dictatorship in Afghanistan. Now 24 million people have been freed of the Ba'ath dictatorship in Iraq. This is really a tremendous forward step. At least it appears to be so far. Things could go wrong. But so far, a tremendous forward step for the Muslim world. This is something that we should be able to see what is wonderful and excellent about what has happened so far, even in the midst of all the tragedy that it has entailed.
Jack, I want to put that to you. Paul Berman describes it as almost an insult to the Muslim world not to separate these rough governments from the culture itself, not to go in and work for liberation. You have, throughout this long debate and right up and into the war, said, Jack, you're against it. It's the wrong way to go. What do you think when you hear Paul Berman's argument?
Well, what I think is what I heard just last week talking to an Iraqi exile, a professor up here at Dartmouth, and he said, I was against this war. I have family in Iraq. And the reason I was against it is because I fear what's going to come next. And the scenario he sketched for me, and by the way, he's a Shiite, is that he said, you can't understand the Shiite worldview here. These people in Iraq, the Shiites have fallen under Iranian influence. They're already forming militia. They are going to essentially treat the United States the way the Shiites of Lebanon treated the Israelis, and after a very short honeymoon, only we didn't get ours, they are going to go into a guerrilla war against to drive the Americans out. And the Americans probably will be driven out, as the Israelis were eventually. And then his real horror, you will have a religious war in Iraq.
That is Shia on Sunni?
Because the Sunnis will arm themselves. He says they're arming themselves now. And meanwhile, the Kurds will just bail out of the country completely, which will create problems with the Turks. And in short, he said things were terrible under Saddam. But it wasn't like Kosovo. There was a sort of daily attrition of, you know, repression and police state and the odd killing and so on. But it wasn't an incipiently genocidal situation. But what he fears is this horror of religious warfare breaking out in his home country.
Well, some awfully big numbers, though, dead after the first Gulf War when there were uprisings that were put down. And, of course, numbers all the way through, but a lot of complexity here. Mark's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello.
Good evening.
I'm going to try to make some real brief comment, and then I'll take the response off the air. I think, first of all, that this effort to conflate the Al-Qaeda movement and the Ba'ath Party under the banner of totalitarianism is a fraud. Any serious scholar of the region knows that. As far as the idea that the French were taking a position only out of economic interest, I think that neglects the fact that in countries around the world, there were popular movements that were pressuring their governments to oppose this war.
True.
The overwhelming majority of people around the world opposed this war, and it's only because the media in this country is not doing its job that most Americans don't realize that. And those were my comments.
We got it, Mark. Good and provocative. Thanks for calling. Paul Berman, this really goes again to your thesis. Mark is not buying the lineage that you draw through the Third Reich and Hitler and Mussolini and European fascism right into the Muslim world, to the Ba'ath Party, and even to some extent into what you call the medieval despots of Saudi Arabia. He says it just doesn't hold up. And B, when there was so much popular opposition globally, who is the United States or the U.S. and the U.K.? Who are they to say, no, you're wrong, we've got it right, off to war we go?
Right. Well, a lot of issues have been raised. The caller said that there was no connection between Al-Qaeda and the Ba'ath Party. But in reality, there are a variety of connections and connections between the Ba'ath Party and terrorism. An example is it is reported that during the last 2 years, Saddam Hussein has supplied $35 million to the Palestinian Intifada, $25,000 for each suicide terrorist, $10,000 for each other victim, with a total sum, as I say, of $35 million.
Is that a totalitarian outreach, or is that one man's idea, in his case, of a freedom struggle?
Well, he would call it a struggle, but I think it's actually the cult of death, which the totalitarian movements have always practiced, and this is the very thing that we have every reason to fear. We've been telling ourselves for years, during the last 20 years, the Muslim totalitarians ensemble, the Ba'ath plus the radical Islamists, have managed to kill millions, literally millions of people. And we've somehow managed to avert our eyes from that and to tell ourselves that we, in the United States, had nothing to worry about.
Tried to wish it away, as you describe it in your book.
Yes. And the reality is that we've been in extreme danger. Finally, the nature of the danger has become clear to us. And when we look at this kind of terrorism, we have to remember, you know, the source of the terrorism isn't just that somebody one day gets mad and decides to go blow himself up by hurling himself into a crowd. What actually happens is that there's a big institutional structure behind this. There are organizations. There's a lot of money. There are clerics advising this. There are journalists and newspapers telling.
And what about Mark's point? We're running down to a break here, but what about his point that global popular opposition ought to count for something? And who is the U.S. to say, you're wrong, we're right, let's go to war?
Well, here it is that Bush did such a really terrible job, and I think he should have been able to say to people that the overthrow of this despot is really in the interests of the world, and I think it is in the interest of the world. It's certainly in the interest of the people of Iraq. It's on our own interest. It's in the interest of Iraq's neighbors. But Bush lacks this ability to be able to speak in this manner, and as a result, we've gone into this war, to use an old phrase, with one hand to hide behind our back. We've gone in with a fantastically efficient and effective military, but with an utterly incompetent political dimension.
Back to Jack Beatty's question there of why it wasn't put in a more straightforward way. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight as the president prepares to announce the end of combat from an aircraft carrier in the Pacific. We're talking about the meaning, the significance of the war with Iraq. You can join the conversation. Has this war changed the world? How? Would the world have been better off if Washington had left Saddam Hussein in power? Are you safer now? Is the world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. As President Bush prepares to announce the end of combat operations in Iraq, we are talking tonight about the meaning, the significance of this war, the war in Iraq. How will historians judge the war? How do you judge it? What does the war in Iraq mean to you? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. My guest tonight is Paul Berman. He's joining us from Brooklyn, New York. He's political and cultural critic and author of the provocative new book, Terror and Liberalism. You're welcome to join us as well. Andrew's calling from Madison. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi, Todd. Maybe you should consider relocating to Wisconsin from the geography of all your callers. It seems like you have a big following here.
Yeah, that's great.
One other point, and that is that I want to thank you for having the show. You're easily the best guy on the radio, and your brilliance and eloquence is second only to that of Jack.
I bow and obey. What's on your mind, Andrew?
Well, quickly, I guess unlike a lot of people, I don't have a problem with us acting like a hyperpower or a global hegemon. I think that's what we are. We obviously have the the military and the economy to back that up more than anyone else out there. What I have issues with, and I think it speaks to a deeper issue within the administration, the current administration, and that is that we have all this power, but it seems like we don't have the understanding of a subtlety or nuance or ability to think outside of our own culture in a way that would make the wielding of that power a hell of a lot more efficient and break a heck of a lot fewer eggs in making our new omelet.
I want to put that to Paul Berman and what an omelet it is. I don't know how big a plate of it I want, but Paul Berman, this comes up repeatedly. Andrew puts it in terms of subtlety and nuance, whether or not the U.S. has the right grasp on things. We talked last night with Sarah Chase, who spends a lot of time in Afghanistan, and about the shortcomings she's seen there, but also the learning curve. I guess I'd add another one piece to Andrew's list, stick-to-itiveness. You might make a reasoned case for this war and it being part of a larger war, and you do. But do you see the United States as the country, as the culture, as the political body to really prosecute it to its full, necessary nuance? Do we have what it takes to stick with this?
Right. Well, I share all these worries. I share every single one of them. But my response to them is to say, well, let's do better. That some people look at Bush and they see all his inadequacies, which are infinite, and they say, well, therefore, we shouldn't do anything at all. And my own response is to say, well, let's as a society try ourselves to make up the deficiencies that we can see in the administration. For instance, in Afghanistan, Bush did a good job militarily of overthrowing the Taliban, even if Bin Laden got away. But he hasn't done and he did a good job of assembling the basic structure of a new government in Afghanistan. Hamid Karzai is a man of obviously liberal principles.
I mean, a structure, if you only look at Kabul, when you get on down, I don't know.
Right. The first foundation stone, this is good. But the rest is utterly inadequate, that we haven't spent enough money there, we don't have enough troops there, we haven't put in enough effort.
But this sounds like a frighteningly short attention span or commitment level, doesn't it?
Well, part of the problem is Bush's, but part of the problem is the left-wing opposition. We should have had a mass left, I think, marching in the streets demanding a greater American commitment to Afghanistan, just like we should have a greater American commitment to Iraq. Instead, what we've had is a certain amount of opposition on the right and a large amount of opposition on the left, essentially calling for the U.S. to retire from these places, to do less. And under these circumstances, well, we can't count on Bush because his own instincts are, in my estimation, not very good. So Bush is doing a kind of halfway job, and the domestic pressure on him is to do even less. And this pressure is coming from the left and the right.
Jack, come in for a minute, because here's this a real double backflip. Of course, we haven't gotten to it, but Paul Berman, it may not be immediately obvious, but Paul Berman is by lifelong work a political liberal in the U.S. context. He's saying liberals shouldn't have had their foot on the brake. They should have been out campaigning for this liberation.
Right.
Well, of course, there was universal support for the war in Afghanistan. The Pope even supported it. So I don't know that his logic applies there. Iraq's a different case. But I think one reason there's this reluctance among the American left is that we just see the Cold War and the struggle against totalitarianism very differently. This was no great moral crusade, or at least put it this way, there are a lot of moral grays in it. I mean, our motto in fighting the war against Soviet totalitarianism seemed to be better they, that is Filipinos, Chileans, Congolese, Angolans, Laotians, Vietnamese, Persians, Iraqis, Nicaraguans, Nicaragua, better they be dead than red. And we committed in our resistance to Soviet expansion, which we did for geostrategic reasons because they were a threat to us, any number of horrifying outrages that still go on. You can't read about Guatemala for 5 minutes without thinking, God, am I an American? Why didn't I stop this? So that's the legacy that our intervention has for people who don't see the Cold War in Paul Berman's terms.
We've just got Paul for another minute, but Paul, your response on that front.
American foreign policy is huge, and it has its pages of crime and tragedy, and its pages of magnificent glory and achievement. And you can point in any direction you want. You can say that what we did in Guatemala was criminal. What we did in Vietnam was fanatical and crazy. What we did in Germany and Italy and Japan was magnificent and great. So we can look back on our own national history and see that the United States has done everything, the worst and also the best. So aware of these possibilities, aware of our potential failures as a society, our failings, and aware also of our potential to do something really decent to defend ourselves and at the same time advance freedom around the world, let's in a sober way look around the world and see what we can do now and see that it should work out well and not badly.
Paul Berman, a final thought then. I know we have to let you go, but in that vast map of American successes and failures, where tonight would you place Iraq? We know where President Bush is likely to put it. Where would you put it?
Well, I say so far so good, but I'm just filled with anxiety and worry because I think that the military part was really just a first step, and that now everything is going to depend on how well we and our allies and the Iraqis themselves are able to move along to the next step. And for that next step to be successful, I think that the American public have to really get behind it, not demand the withdrawal of American troops and a return to isolationism, whether that be called right wing or left wing, but a greater involvement with a greater sense of idealism and a greater sense of the humanitarian goal.
Paul Berman is author of the new book, Terror and Liberalism. Paul, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
I'm very happy to have been with you.
Jack Beatty, please stand by. I want to turn now to Newsweek magazine contributing editor Eleanor Clift. She's following developments in Washington and the political and foreign policy implications of the end of, as the president is expected to say momentarily, major combat operations in Iraq. Eleanor, good evening. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening. Glad to be with you.
So I'm sure all of Washington has been bathing grimly or joyously, depending on the party, I suppose, in the images of George Bush in jumpsuit on flight deck this afternoon. What are you expecting to hear when the president steps to the microphone there on the high seas?
Well, he's going to stop short of declaring victory. He'll use some carefully qualified language to say that the major military combat activities have come to an end. But I think he wants to prepare the country for continuing casualties. And also, I don't think he wants to officially declare the war over, because then the international community will increase the pressure to start the rebuilding process, and I think he wants to delay that because the country clearly has not been secured yet.
But you know, of course, at some level, President Bush is going to present this as a triumph tonight. How has the outcome of the war in Iraq already filtered through lines of power, dominance, ideology in Washington, Eleanor Clift?
Well, again, I think his language will be careful, but the imagery is something else. And Ari Fleischer, the White House spokesman, said that the metaphor of appearing on an aircraft carrier that's bringing
says it all
home troops is suggests that the cessation of military activity and the troops are coming home, and it suggests a return by the president as well to the shores of domestic policy. And he wants to avoid the mistake of his father of appearing too preoccupied with foreign issues, and he wants to show that he's now fighting to get this economy to recover. But so far, he's been unable to translate the increased popularity over the war into increased clout on Capitol Hill. And the economy isn't recovering. The stock market war rally is petered out. And he's the first president in memory to have lost so many jobs while in office. Some interesting statistics. The first President Bush left office creating 2 million more jobs than when he began. President Clinton created 20 million jobs, and some of that was the internet bubble, but that was still an impressive number. This President Bush is 2 million jobs down, and he has no hope of recovering those jobs. So statistically, if you look at how presidents get reelected, his reelection chances would not be very good, except for 9/11 and the way that he has managed to cast himself as a war president.
Well, then, in that case, the economy may improve, but it might not. Eleanor Clift, it begs the question, does Washington expect to see another war before the presidential election in 2004?
You do hear some cynics on the Democratic side say that maybe along about next January or February we could be preparing for another military encounter. But rationality tells me I don't exactly see where that's going to happen. I don't think it makes sense to go into Syria or Iran or North Korea. I think the Cubans are worried they could be next. But there's anxiety all around the world that this president has a list and that he's checking off these countries one by one and that he's been emboldened by this military victory.
And what's your sense, Eleanor, of the impact of the military success? Has it shifted American foreign policy dramatically onto a new track, or are we still in the straddle game, the Powell-Rumsfeld straddle here?
I think there are huge divisions within the administration. I think Afghanistan was a quick military victory, but it's been a slow, steady decline ever since. And even though Secretary of State Rumsfeld was in Afghanistan, I think even today, saying the war is over there and the rebuilding will begin, that you can't leave Kabul and be safe. It's the rest of the country has fallen back into the hands of warlords, and remnants of the Taliban are reconstituting, and Osama bin Laden is likely somewhere in that mountainous area. And if Iraq mirrors Afghanistan, the attention will shift. And the country may not be paying close attention, but we could be looking at a steady decline there as well, and as opposed to the glorious rebuilding of democracy that so many in the administration have promised. On the other hand, if this White House really presses ahead and gets a two-state solution in the Middle East and solves the Israeli-Palestinian problem, I'll be crying Hosanna along with everybody else.
Hallelujah.
But,
yeah
I think that's the chances for that are fairly remote.
Eleanor Clift, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Eleanor Clift is contributing editor for Newsweek magazine. Well, Jack, the images will be coming up already of the Great Pacific, the president surrounded by the troops. What a saga this war has been, and Eleanor Clift lays out everything that now stands before us. Talk about imposing, rebuilding Iraq, the domestic economy waits, and those two just for starters.
Just for starters, we're going to have pictures of the president embedded, you might say, in the U.S. military.
And bedding down tonight to sleep on the aircraft carrier.
Yes, and I forgive me for being cynical, but this is a massive campaign event, and we're going to see this picture again and again and again throughout the next campaign. You know, on this Iraq intervention, we have kind of a history on this show. The Sunday after, we went on the air the Sunday after September 11th, and on that day, Paul Wolfowitz at a meeting at Camp David said, we need to make the war against al-Qaeda a big war. We need to go after Iraq. And he was not
excited.
They said, no, we don't want to do that. Well, 2 days later, we announced on our program that the very day, a group of neoconservative intellectuals wrote the president and said, unless you attack Iraq, the war on terror will be a failure. Well, in the year since, and more than a year, they have got their way. And you might say that those letter writers, Bill Kristol was the chief one, are a little like Harriet Beecher Stowe. You know, when Lincoln met her at the White House, he said, so you're the little lady who wrote the book that started this big war.
And tonight, as George Bush steams toward the coast of California trying to bring the imagery back home, I'm not sure that with that huge stake in the ground in Iraq, Jack, that it's going to be so easy for the American mind to fully come home again. We are committed.
We are committed, and we have taken an action that will breed a reaction. We just don't know how serious or where or when.
Well, we'll listen to the president. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is W.